family operation. My wife helps out on the farm, whatever we need to do. I have two children, a daughter, Riley. She's 14, and my son, Strand, he's 13. We left Dad at home now, helping out on the farm, getting the chores done. We have been in a commercial deal, like I said, for about 25 years. We're new to the seed stock. We have registered Angus and Hereford, and we use Brahmin, cross with Brahmin for the heat tolerance and the longevity to produce our replacements. We'll breed our Brahmins to our Hereford and Angus and take that F1, and we'd like to go back on those to produce the black body calves, which we find does well at our marketing time.
Mr. Jimmy?
I'm Jimmy Holloman, and I'm a native of Mississippi, and it's good to be back. We run a small cow-calf operation, purebred operation, and we're just one of 10 partners in that, and black Simmental cattle. And we started Circle H Cattle Farm in 1982, and when I left Mississippi, I took a job with Auburn University as director of the Black Belt Research Center, and that was a natural move from there into the seed stock business. I see some of my fellow Auburn people out here. We had some Angus cattle there. We did a lot of different breeds, crossbreed EPDs that were kind of familiar, you know, with this group way back in the early days of EIF. And I guess some of the stuff we did there at the station pertaining to fescue and the novel fescue, and we actually found the enophyte there on the station that causes all this problem. And I thought we'd have that thing solved in about 2 years and give the cow a pill and move over, and it's 40 years later, and we're still answering. We answered a lot of questions, but we opened up a lot of new questions. But our operation is one of 10 in a company called Next Step Cattle Company. We're all located in Alabama, but we're from the north part of Alabama all the way down to probably about an hour and a half from here. Some of our cattle are down there. And I serve as president of that organization, and we pretty much make the mating decisions. Our marketing manager, Tommy Brown, a lot of y'all know, is involved, and so all the herds are alike, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit when we get through with introductions. Okay.
Mr. John?
Yeah, I'm John Raftopoulos from Northwest Colorado, Moffat County. A little more diverse, kind of a hell of a lot further north than these guys, in a lot different environment. But we're in the high desert kind of country. We range from 5,600 feet to 9,500 feet. So our challenges are a little bit different than most of the low-lying producers. So we focus on – our producers want cattle that will perform in the mountains. And the high mountain disease or brisket disease is a huge problem with our producers, because some of those people – we'll have their headquarters at 9,500 feet, so they're very concerned about the PAP score, which is really the only mechanism, the only measurement that we really have to provide Angus cattle to those people. Other breeds, a lot of the exotic breeds were developed in the higher elevations, you know, France, Germany, Switzerland. So those cattle have had natural selection through their evolution to elevation. So the main problem is with the Angus breed, which is of course the most popular breed, the most desirable and sought after breed, definitely in Colorado, basically through most of the northern United States. So it's definitely a problem. We've got a diverse operation. We run about 3,000 cows, of which about 1,100 are registered cows. We've got kind of a unique, about 12 years ago, we'd like to follow our cattle through the feedlot. So we weren't, as we followed them through, we weren't very excited about what we were seeing as we followed them through. So being like most people in this room, wanting to progress and do the best we can do and provide the best product that we can, we knew that the best way to do that was through AI. So we started there was a paradigm as large producers and maybe even small producers that you can't use AI. And being a veterinarian, too, I graduated from CSU in 1978. I also had that paradigm that large producers can't use AI. It's too much of a problem. Well, we just started slowly. We knew that if we were going to progress and be one of the best operations in the area, that we had to use AI. So just little by little, we developed systems with the seeder that we could use AI. So the main thing is that we had to have, it was a mindset, of course, and it takes a lot of work, but once you develop the systems, it's a lot easier. And once you develop the system and you see the quality of cattle that you produce, then you can evolve into the next step. So we went from producing cattle that we wanted to produce good females and good feeder cattle. As we started seeing the cattle develop and the quality of the cattle, we thought we need to add some value to these cattle. So we got into a commercial bull program. And once we started that, we bought some registered cattle and started the registered program. So in the period of about 12 years, we've got our commercial cattle, our commercial bull program, we call our diamond bull program, is an accumulation of, well, the pigs and the chickens, maybe I'm being a little bit too loud here, or too long, but the pigs and the chickens, as you all know, are all, when they identify the genetics that work, they replicate those. Us in the cattle business, if you wanted to find, you know, full brothers or full sisters, you'd have to go to I don't know how many different sales. So it just didn't make sense to me that we couldn't produce, you know, as bull raisers. Of course, you got to have the people that are looking for the next great sire. But in our program, we just wanted to develop bulls for the commercial man that work in our environment, the high altitude, high desert environment. So we've implemented several different objectives that we'd like to use. We use high accuracy sires. We'll experiment with a few young sires, but most of the bulls we like to have that we use have to have at least 85% accuracy. So that we don't, because we replicate them, we'll take 1,000 cows and breed them all to the same bull. So to develop that uniformity and consistency is we took all our cow herd, bred them all to one bull. At that time it was 878, new design 878. We did that for 2 years. Took all those half-sisters, bred them to Keneally lead-on. Took those and bred the three-quarter sisters of those. Bred them to new level. So we had 7-8s and then from new level to in-focus and in-focus to mainline. To Alliance I-87, and then New Standard, and now Absolute. So try to find the sires that work in our environment. We like cattle that are big-volumed. We don't focus on just the carcass. We want positive carcass traits, but we want cattle that are moderate-sized, have great performance, and good fertility. You know, as we've heard it before, four times the most important economic trait is fertility. In most operations, I would say, and especially in ours, because we treat all our registered cows, if they don't come in bred, they leave. So that's basically what we do. It gets, of course, more involved in like that. But the adaptability part, we put extra selection on our cattle because of the altitude that we're at. Another thing that we do is, you talk about pampered. We don't pamper our cattle. We treat them just like a commercial person would. So we calve in large pastures, have two riders with them, try to weigh every calf, identify every calf. But now with all this imputation coming up here, some of our cattle we can't. Like I said, we've got the registered herd, and then we've got the what we call the diamond herd. That's the cattle that have been AI'd are from AI background, 5-6 generations of AI. Those cattle calve out on big pastures, you know, 5 to 6, 8,000 acre pastures. So we're not able to get around and tag all them. So the imputation and the ability to use DNA is going to be huge in that project, where we can get the CED and the birth weight and all the, without actually having the birth weight. So anyway, a little bit long there, but.
That's fine. So you see that for the panel, for the most part, we've got really three different environments that we're dealing with here this morning. So with that, if I'd like to open the floor. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask these guys, then feel free to do that. If you have any questions this morning.
What's your biggest challenge for female development and getting heifers from weaning to that second calf on the ground?
That's open to you. Ron, help start.
I guess the biggest challenge would be nutrition, I would say. Getting them to their weight, to their size, where they need to be, so they can go ahead and milk and perform and breed back instead of still trying to grow and get to their mature size. If you can go ahead and get them, if we can get them grown from weaning to before they have their first calf, we feel like we'll step ahead and they'll do fine and go ahead and breed back for us.
Good, Jimmy. In our program, we're in kind of a unique area of Alabama. We're kind of in central Alabama, but we're in fescue country, and a lot of people don't relate to that. It's fescue all over Alabama, but it's a strip that runs through Mississippi and Alabama soil type called the Black Belt, and we grow fescue and Dallas grass and Johnson grass. I know a lot of y'all think people put you in jail for growing Johnson grass, but it's a pretty good hay crop, and that's the reason the little town where I'm from exists. They grew Johnson grass hay for the Army and the coal mines, and they shipped it out of there. Is a junction so they could go all four ways. That was way before my time, before I was born, but that's the reason town's there. But we can put our cattle on fescue, and that's part of the adaptability. Cattle, you know, dirty fescue is tough to get around, but most of ours in our area, we can dilute it with Dallas grass or with white clovers or something like that. And as the cattle that are raised there, they seem to be more adapted, you know, and that's one of the pluses to our bull sale. And we sell yearling bulls. They like slick-haired bulls, and we sort of let them weed themselves out. And the heifers that don't work are those, you know, that are sold. But we can put them on fescue and supplement them according to NRC requirements. And we don't have a big problem getting those heifers bred back, you know, and if we keep the nutrition up. We're fall calvers. I didn't mention that. And that's a niche market in itself in Alabama, because our more progressive commercial people are the fall calvers, because, you know, if you look at the price cycle, it seems like it goes up. You know, we sell in August and September in those board sales, and that's the thing. The average size of cow herd in Alabama is about 25 cows. So we have our focus with our bull group, the Next Step Cattle Company, is to sell yearling bulls to those guys, and we don't focus much on the purebred thing. You know, all our bulls are registered, and all our cattle are on total herd enrollment through the American Simmental Association. That's one of the requirements to be in our group. We want total herd reporting, and we also suggest, and most of them do, that we want ultrasound data on every heifer and bull. And that's a little tough to do sometimes, but so far it's worked out pretty good. And so far as female selection, it depends on what you're shooting for. We'll have those high marbling heifers, and because we kind of put an emphasis on carcass traits since we were back in the Sunshine Program, and this is our 21st sale coming up in December. you know, some of those high marbling females are not going to be your best looking females. And it's my job and Tommy Brown's job to convince those guys that those heifers, while they may not look right and they're 185 API, you need to keep them around and give them a chance. And sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. So the female thing, we try to keep the top end. Sometimes you sell one of those pretty ones, you know, so you can get a little extra money. And you look down the road sometimes, and she probably wasn't the best heifer anyway. So that's one of the routes we go.
Yeah, the heifer development is probably one of the biggest challenges to trying to do that effectively and cheaply. So we've probably done, well, at least three different ways. First of all, we used to just close them up in the feedlot, feed them all winter long. They'd come out weighing 850 to 900 pounds. They'd hit grass. We'd AI them before they'd leave, try to get them out within the first 5 days so the embryonic implantation would take place when we got there. But we were having problems with that. Our conception rate was not very good, usually from 80 to 85%, because we'd go from, that happened usually during May, so we'd go from a feed lot ration to a lush grass or a short grass type of a washy type of grass situation, so we'd get a decline in nutrition. So we were losing a lot of those embryos at that time, and the cattle maybe would gain maybe 50 to 100 pounds the whole time on grass. So after some of the work with Rick that Rick Funston did in the University of Nebraska, where his research showed that by the time you get, if you have a heifer has to get back to her body condition score as a second calver before she really starts cycling consistently. So with that information, we determined that we were maybe overdeveloping our heifers, need to have a little bit different program to develop our heifers. So we would wean them and then put them on corn stalks. We've got a part interest in Nebraska in a feedlot, so we'd take cattle there. But so we'd start, we'd wean the cattle, put them on corn stalks, feed them a ration every other day or every third day just to keep them coming, but keep them in green type of flesh. And then in March, we'd bring them in and flush them and then breed in May and then come home again. But still, we were getting, the heifers were in a little better condition, probably a little greener, but then our conception rates were getting better, but not as good as we'd like to see them. So now we've implemented a program where we're keeping them at home. We're feeding them hay and a little bit of silage, and then turning them out to pasture. They're probably, instead of weighing 8.5 like they were before, they're probably weighing 7.5, but we're breeding them later and letting them be on grass for about 30 days before we breed them, and then we'll get some of that data there. But I think overall that'll be a little bit better program than what we had before. So there's a lot of variability, and it's definitely that's all your young genetics. That's what you want to keep in the herd for sure. This year we're breeding about 1,100 heifers, of which there'll be about 400 of them that are registered, and the rest will be commercial or program cattle off our AI program. We'll breed them to about all the commercial cattle will just get one bull, and the registered cattle will also get a different bull. But we use the heck out of just a few bulls.
I have one for you, guys. When we think about adaptation and we think about, you know, developing those females in that environment and what they do, you know, a lot of times when we're looking for genetics to make improvements, a lot of times we may use some bulls from different environments. So what's been your experiences with that, maybe using bulls outside of your environment and bringing them in, and maybe in those calves, and how they've acclimated, or what changes have you seen, or differences from a performance standpoint maybe that were there, if there were any, on using those bulls?
Of course, we're heavily in the AI and have one herd that we flush a good many cows in. And of course, we use the sire summary and pick those bulls. And of course, there's nothing in there about hair coat or how slick they are or how heat tolerant they are. So we, you know, you kind of have to ask around about the bulls. And but you know, we use, if you're selling purebred bulls or registered bulls, you know, they want those popular pedigrees, so you are kind of pushed that way. But we use a lot of bulls that are developed in our program because we're, some of our half-blood cows are in sixth generation, you know, halves on halves on halves and three-quarters the same way. But, you know, there's some lines of bulls out there that we have culled. If an AI company's in our country, if they put in there, well, this bull's got good hair, that usually means he don't work for us, you know, because we don't really need a whole lot of hair, you know, down there. 100 degrees and 90% humidity, you know, that doesn't go together. But, you know, the we've kind of identified some lines that work for us, and they work in South Dakota. We send, you know, we sell in basically a 100-mile range area, but we do have bulls go to Texas and South Dakota and along the East Coast, and those bulls work there because they come back, you know, and buy more bulls. We found our bull customers, if you'll listen to them, they'll tell you what they want. And we're a little different. You know, the trend now is for these five-frame bulls, and our producers want six to six-and-a-half-frame bull. Being a cow-calf state, they sell, most of the calves in Alabama are sold at weaning, and they want those extra pounds. And and the complicated thing is I don't want all my cows six and a half to seven frame, but I want my bulls there. So that's a fine line you have to walk there, you know. So, and we, the way we market, I mean, develop our bulls, while we're talking about bulls, we want them to have 3 pounds weight per day of age up to the sale. We develop them basically on free choice soy hulls, and been doing that for like 20 something years, and it works good. A long time ago, they used to tell me, you know, breeders, bull buyers want thin, hard bulls. Well, they may want them, but they won't pay for them. So we want them, you know, body condition sick. You know, they're ready. They're sale. They look good at sale. But we have found we can free choice soy hulls and a little bit of hay and get the 3 pound weight per day of age on them. And it works real well, and our bulls don't melt on them as they go out there. Selling yearling bulls was a little challenge at first. And then we could kind of show them the advantage of that extra year. And then the two-year-olds, trying to tell two-year-old bulls to us was just not something we wanted to get into, you know, because they act like teenagers right after you see them and check them, you know, and fight and tear everything up. So the yearling bull thing is what we decided to go with 20 years ago. And then Alabama, it's kind of a graduation thing. You start with Alabama BCA, and they used to have a number of sales you could consign your bulls to if you was a small breeder. And we, most of our partners, we used to call them cooperators, and now they're partners, were successful in that. And then we felt like we graduated into our own sale. And one of the reasons was in the early 80s, we couldn't hardly give away, late 80s, couldn't hardly give away Simmental bulls in Alabama, you know. And so I was breeding the blacks, and my Angus friends would tell me they were generic blacks because, you know, I grew up an Angus breeder, but they've since come around because, you know, it's a good partnership with the Sim-Angus thing. And and back early, we also played around with Sim-Angus HT. We were calling them Sun Crosses because that's where we developed them, and they were basically our three-quarter Simmental cows. We put Brangus bulls on them, and it was a good market for those cattle, but we just couldn't produce enough of them. And when we went a different route with the Next Step Cattle Company, we don't have a partner that wants to produce those. But it's, I think it's a big market in our area for the Sim-Angus HT cattle, which have 3/16 and almost none showing in the calf, you know, so that would work well.
We have brought some bulls in from north, from Idaho, and as long as we find, if we can bring them in the winter months, January, February, that we seem that they adapt just fine. By middle of summer, they have shed it off. and we hadn't had any issues. So I find that the cattle, well, the Hereford cattle anyway, the bulls, that they're just adapting to the environment. We hadn't had any real issues.
Yeah, our biggest challenge is finding bulls that work at altitude. Like I said, Tim Holt developed the PAP test, the pulmonary arterial pressure test. That is probably it's the only mechanism that we have to really to test cattle to see if they will work at altitude. But so we have to test. Well, there's three or four different ways that we investigate, I guess, what bulls are going to work in our system. ABS has a, and I think the other semen companies have. They can test cattle at CSU's got a research farm that was donated to them at 8,000 feet that they'll do some progeny testing there. We use that as kind of a guideline. We'll ask other producers, you know, that are higher elevation if they've noticed any sires that are being a problem. And, of course, Tim Holt, he's tested 370,000 head in his 20-some years as a veterinarian, so he's a good place to get good information. And then we'll test sires our own, the new sires that we want to test. We'll use a few of them. We'll breed like 100 cows to each of the four or five sires that we want to test, and then go through and get our own information, and then use those in mass if they do pass. Now we keep. You know, it's a huge problem in our area at the higher elevations, but it's also showing up. If you talk to the people in the feedlots, most of the cattle, or a lot of the cattle, the biggest percentage of them, I think, are fed in the either in the Midwest or up in the northern plains, you know, in Nebraska, a lot of them in eastern Colorado. And those people are starting, if you talk to veterinarians, consulting veterinarians that are doing work in those feedlots, they'll tell you that the second leading cause of death in feedlot cattle is brisket or heart problems, congestive heart failure. And usually that occurs, it's probably the first cause of death in cattle that are near finish, which is probably the worst time to lose one. But as the cattle get fat, it puts more stress on the heart. And like I said, most of our people, the people in the mountain elevations our people are demanding that we have a PAP test. But the problem is there are certain lines of Angus cattle that are very prone to high mountain or brisket disease, but where there's no selection pressure on them, on people that raise Angus bulls at lower elevation, those bulls, our cutoff is usually around 50. Most of the people that go to the high mountains, they want them 40 and under. So in anything that we have that's over 50, we go ahead and band and take them to finish. Now, some cattle, and there's some sires that'll test in the 80s and the 100s, and we just send them right to the sale barn because the probability of them dying is great. But a lot of the Angus breeders, you lower elevation, you don't have the need to do that. But sometimes I think it's the people that, you know, the feeders that are buying these cattle from lower elevation, they don't really have any certainty that when those cattle go to the feedlot at the higher elevations, when they're shipped north, that they're going to have to pencil in a little bit higher death loss because, like I said, they're seeing more and more of it because some of the popular sires, you know, were higher PAP test sires, so they've been injected into the pedigrees of a lot of the Angus cattle in the breed. So that's probably our biggest challenge is finding bulls that will work at high elevation.
Any questions?
Usually the threshold is right around 5,000 feet according to Tim Holt, from 4,000 to 5,000 feet is where you start seeing
the stress on the lung, where you get the arteries start to narrow and put more pressure on the heart. Then, of course, it's like 1 point per thousand, but I think sometimes it's a little bit higher than that. Because when you go to 9,000 feet, and then some areas are worse than others. There's a Walden area and there's South Park. Some areas are actually even very hard to get cattle to pap test, an Angus cow or an Angus bull to pap test in those areas. There's either something in the water or something in the minerals that put even more stress on the lungs.
Interested to see with the work you've done in making such closely related animals in large volume, I'm interested to hear your perspective of what you've seen from a uniformity standpoint in those animals. What's it like, and is it what you expected?
Well, of course, we got the bell curve, and we've narrowed that bell curve up, and it's a beautiful thing. It really is a neat thing to walk into a pen of 200 bulls, and then they're basically look all the same. That's one thing that our bull buyers really are impressed by, is that the uniformity and consistency of our bulls, and plus the performance, of course, comes along with that. Of course, we've got on both edges of the bell curve that we cull. And the thing is, we've got population genetics on our side where we've got, you know, we'll wean 800 bull calves, so we're pretty tough on them. And then what we do is we'll band them and then just take them to finish, and then we'll get our carcass data. But the thing is, you know, my eye, the way that I like cattle, hopefully is the same way my customers like them, because if it's not, I'm in big trouble. So I've got to kind of, you know, get bull buyers that like what I like, so we don't get near the diversity that you do in other bull programs, just because the way that we're breeding them. But it's pretty, it's neat. And then, like I said, we've got 7 generations now of AI. So as we progress down the road another 5 or 10 years, the main thing is we don't want to stub our toe, because if we do it, we do it in a bad way. But that's the problem with breeding so many to a single sire. But the thing is, too, that I've been kind of, you know, the program and the principle, the objective is to provide all those high-quality, consistent sires. But I still have people that come in and still, instead of going through and buying one whole sire group or buying 10 of the top, they'll still go through and pick the whole offering instead of basically figuring out that we've done most of the work for them, that even if they buy the number 20 bull, he's still the same as the number 1 bull, a lot 1 bull. It's still that's why I've been a little bit disappointed that people haven't really caught on to the concept as well. Because advertising-wise, marketing-wise, when you can list, like on Superior, that these bulls are all out of Alliance I-87, or they're all, you know, they're all out of this program, it's catching on some, but it's not near as fast as I thought it would.
Of course, at Next Step, we don't fool near those numbers, but our goal was we sell from quarter bloods up to purebreds. And if you walk in our pens, and it didn't happen overnight, but it's happening now, if you walk in at our bull sale, those quarter bloods look almost just like the purebreds. And you can't tell them apart unless you look at the papers. Now, we went through some growing pains early when we had those first F1s, and they'd sire those calves, and some of them look like those red Simmental mamas they had, and some of them look like the Angus daddies they had, you know, and we took some backlash on that because they were going on mongrelized cow herds, and that's what we got a lot of in the southeast. You know, it'd be good if we just had a lot of just straight Angus herd or straight Hereford. It would have helped us early, but we didn't have that. But now, you know, through multi-generation breeding, you know, our cattle are pretty consistent, and we're kind of proud of that. but we still bring in some of these outside bulls, and we buy a lot of bulls around the country. But the challenge is getting 10 herds that are scattered all over Alabama, and Alabama's a long state, and making sure everybody's breeding the same thing, you know, doing what our program is. Because we decided years ago everybody can sell bulls, but we need to have a program that they can buy into so that they know what they're doing, and when they come back, we know we can help them. And it's been pretty successful there. We're, of course, not a great big operation. And as we developed, we've got other semi-Angus and Angus herds that are kind of following some of our pattern, and they're popping up all over the state. And we don't look at it as competition. We look at it as complementation, because if somebody was talking about the cow herd is going to grow, well, we don't have enough bulls in Alabama to service the cows that are out there. So, you know, we think we're all in this together, and we're all going to help each other. So we've been real pleased with you know, the way our cattle are going. And I'm an official old person now. I can qualify for Social Security, so I don't know how much longer we're going to be in this thing. But we're excited about the future that we have with our seed stock. You know, I'm bad about calling it purebred, but I just need to call it registered, you know, because there's nothing purebred about a quarter blood semi.
I would say I don't worry too much about trying to get all same sibs, or because it's just like people, we all like different ice cream, we like different flavors. So as long as the quality of my bulls is there and the traits and the maternals in them, the genetics of the bulls, I'll use several different ones just to have the for the customers to have options on what genetics they may like. I am kind of working on watching udder quality and eye pigmentation in our Herefords. So that's one place that we need to improve. So that's one thing that I'm trying to really watch.
Ron, I've got a question for you way back here in the back. I think you said you've got Hereford and Angus cattle, as well as you're using Brahman bulls. How are you marketing your half-blood steers, your quarter-blood steers, and along with your Hereford and Angus steers? Kind of how's your marketing mindset on that? And then for all three of y'all, how are you managing your first calf heifers to second calf, getting those cattle rebred? Y'all may have covered it and I might have missed it, but how are you managing them with as valuable as what they are? You're trying to get every one of those young females bred possible.
I would say on the marketing, that is a tough deal there. But what we'll do is just have them in load lots alike. So the half-blood steers will be shipped together. You wouldn't commingle them, and you could have, you know, a load of quarter-bloods. That's how we get it done. And we just sell them straight off the farm. We have scales and sell load lots off the farm is how we do it. Far as getting the heifers bred back, the biggest thing that I see is nutrition. The genetics can be there, but if the cattle are not getting adequate nutrition, you struggle getting them bred. So we calve kind of like he said, we calve in the fall. So we take advantage of our winter forage, rye grass and oats, and that seems to help us get it done.
We kind of cheat on our first calf heifers. We will creep feed those calves and messes up my contemporary groups, but I figure it's better to have her pregnant, you know, that next year than it was to mess up my contemporary groups. But being fall calvers, we can sometimes, if we've got stockpile fescue or ryegrass or something, we can put those first calf heifers on the better forages, and that helps a lot. And like I said, we haven't really had, you know, a big problem with that. If I really get to looking at my date, a lot of times it's that third calf when they've really come in, you know, they're really milking, they're really producing, is you have to pay attention to them and make sure that they get bred back then, because they really have become cows and, you know, they're wide open. So, But, you know, we, like I said, we don't have a whole lot of problem getting those heifers rebred, but we take care of them.
Of course, that's your newest genetics, the cattle that you want to really keep in the herd. So it is a problem for everybody to get those bred because they're trying to grow and they're trying to produce a calf. And then we put all this pressure on high production, high performance on these cattle. So we added that much more stress to getting them bred back again. So we isolate them and use them as a separate management group, try to give them a little bit better country. But we found that calving early in February, what we're doing is trying to move everything back so we're more in tune with our environment. And what we'd like to do basically, when we confine them, you know, we'll have different, you'll have the scours, you'll have diphtheria, they'll mother two calves or one cow will mother three calves and gets to be kind of a, when they're in confinement. So optimally, we want to have a line of bulls they'll calf without assistance. Even if we want to be able to just turn our heifers out right with our cows or in a separate pasture and calve them out on the range. The cattle, you know, a lot of times, about half the time we can winter, well, all our cows will stay out. We only bring in about 60 days, and sometimes on a good winter like this year, we can leave most of them out, and they'll graze all winter long. But ideally, the cows are a lot happier when they're out on range, you know, in our environment. And then when spring comes along, they just blossom as soon as the grass starts to green. So basically, we think with time that we'll be able to have enough selection on the cow side, enough genetics for light birth weight on the cow side, on the heifer side, and then with bull selection that we'll be able to just turn the cows out, turn the heifers out, let them calve and let them kind of come with the environment. Of course, our registered cows, we treat them, if you ask me which cow was our best cow, our highest performing cow, you know, I could probably find her in there, but we don't focus on that stuff. We've got that many cows, we just treat them like a commercial cow. If they come in open, she's gone. It doesn't matter. So that's how we do our adaptability. If they're open, they're gone. I mean, that's how they adapt to the environment. So, but with the heifers, that's kind of the direction we're going. Calving later, conforming to the environment, and then using genetics to minimize calving loss.
These cows that you bred as heifers all to the same bull the first time, now those cows are 7 years old. Are you still breeding that whole group of cows to the same bull or these, not necessarily the same bull that you bred your heifers to, but are you still breeding those cows, or are you changing from year to year on the bulls that you're using?
Yeah, every 2 years. As soon as those heifers start coming into production, we'll change the bull. So we'll breed the heifers and the cows that are in that, in what we call our diamond herd, which is the generations of AI sires. They'll all get the same bull. So the heifers and the cows, every 2 years, we'll change and go to a high accuracy sire. So there'll be 1,100 cows that'll be bred to that bull.
Do we have any more questions? Maybe one more? Anybody?